science, technology, society, our lives, philosophy, and religion. This is Spark Dialogue Podcast, where it all comes together. I'm Elizabeth Fernandez.
It's a story we've heard many times before, especially during the Christmas season. Wise men following a star and traveling many miles to find the child Jesus and his mother Mary, bringing gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. We depict this event in our nativity scenes, and school children act it out in plays. We hear just one account of this story, from the Gospel of Matthew, which describes the wise men following a star which came to rest over the place that Jesus was born. And it is here, in Bethlehem, that the wise men find the King of the Jews. But is this star a real astronomical event? Today, our guest is Dr. Peter Barthel, a professor in astrophysics at the Kapteyn Astronomical Institute at the University of Groningen. At the celebration of his university's 400th anniversary, Peter helped to host a conference on the Star of Bethlehem, bringing together scholars in religion, history, culture, and astronomy to discuss what the star could have been and what it means. This conference led to the publication of an interdisciplinary book, The Star of Bethlehem and the Magi, which Peter edited along with George Van Cooten. So welcome to the podcast, Peter.
Hello.
So this conference brought together a lot of people in very different fields, historians, religious scholars, and astronomers. And among all these people, is there a general consensus that the Star of Bethlehem was an actual astronomical event? Or do many people maybe believe that it was a literary device invented up by Matthew for his gospel?
Yeah, all of that. So there are certainly people who believe that the whole story is true. There are people who believe that nothing is true at all. And so I'm of course, somewhere in the middle then. I really believe that Matthew used historical elements in the story, but I also think up that he made some details for other reasons, which we can also explain.
Okay. So there's a lot of speculation on what the Star of Bethlehem was. Is there some sort of idea of what sort of possibilities the Star of Bethlehem could have been?
Yeah, of course, the topic has been around for many, many centuries. But particularly in the last 200 years or so, people have been thinking about what could have been really the case. Mm-hmm. So there had been already theories by Kepler that there were certain periodicities in events. So he said that maybe it was a supernova. But I would say since the mid 1800s, people started to know how stars work, mm-hmm. and they wanted to find a physical explanation. And now, nowadays, of course, we have beautiful digital planetariums that you can even download as freeware on your laptop, and you can run and simulate the sky at whatever place and whatever time.
Okay.
So that is what we also did, of course, and that is also why we can sort of give credit to some explanations and to take credit off other explanations because they're just not that spectacular. The other thing is, of course, we read that Herod was extremely surprised, and he also asked the Magi where the phenomenon was that they had seen.
Right.
So many of us believe that nothing was seen in Judea. And this is, of course, an important element.
Yeah.
So maybe there was nothing spectacular that could be seen. Otherwise, Herod and the people in Judea would have seen it themselves.
Yeah, I think that's actually a really good point, because if it was something like a really bright supernova or a comet that everyone would be running outside and being able to see something, but we don't hear that. We hear that, we do hear the surprise of Herod.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So a lot of the explanations that talk about novae, supernovae, conjunctions of planets, comets, also fireballs and so on, these I don't think are very valid because the Jews saw nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And so many conjunctions of planets have been proposed. And many of them always involve Venus, because Venus is so bright, as you can see tonight. So if Venus is very close to Jupiter, or is sort of standing in the same direction as Jupiter, you get an extra bright object in the sky. But Venus is a planet which is very close, so this conjunction of Venus and, say, Jupiter or Saturn will last 2 or 3 days, and then there's already a separation between the two. So then you do not see it any longer as a single object, but as a double object. Mm-hmm. And the gospel is really talking about a star. The Magi came to Herod, and they say, we have seen his star. So singular, and they use the word his. Mm-hmm. So this is another question that we have. What do they mean with the word his star? And like I said, it's a singular star. So I don't think this is a conjunction of two objects.
Okay. So what is the idea of what the star of Bethlehem actually is then?
So I think very good explanation has been proposed by an American in 1999, Molnar, who proposed that this is nothing astronomy at all. It's astrology. Mm-hmm. So we have to imagine that in these countries in Mesopotamia, there were lots of observatories. Every major town had its own observatory, and all that the people could see every night, because it was always clear, were the stars and the planets. So we know also of tables that they kept. So they kept tables of the positions of the planets. They knew the positions of the planets extremely well. For centuries, they had been studying the positions of these planets. And they were, of course, relating the positions of these planets against the background of the stellar constellations to explain the things as they were happening around them. So astrology was very important. Every city had astrologers. Politics involved astrologers. Molnar then suggested that in April minus six, there was a very, very special sunrise on the morning of April. I have to look it up. I think it was April 17. Then I will look it up. Yeah, it was April 17 in minus six. Okay. Then in early in the morning, just before sunrise, there were several planets, all within one constellation, the constellation of Aries. And it was the first time in that year that Jupiter could be seen again. This is the so-called heliacal rising of Jupiter. So Jupiter had been fairly close to the sun, so it was only, seen during the daytime, but then you can't see it. And on that morning of this April 17, Jupiter was then seen high in the sky, Venus was seen high in the sky. All the planets were in that constellation of Aries, so there was a massing of planets, and the moon was actually occulting Jupiter later during the day. Now, this is nothing special, you could say, but Jupiter is a regal planet. And an occultation of Jupiter with all the planets nearby was really special, and that triggered the interest of the astrologers. We had experts at our meeting who were involved with the history of astrology and antique astrologers in those days and in those countries. And they indeed suggest that this was a very special horoscope, so to say.
So the planets that you're talking about, Jupiter, I'm assuming Saturn and Venus.
And Mars.
And Mars, okay.
Yeah.
So the ones that are particularly visible with the naked eye.
Yeah, all five of them were massing together with the sun and with the moon. And on that particular morning, regal planet Jupiter was seen again. It had not been visible for many months. Mm-hmm. And later during that day, it was even occulted by the moon, which is also a special thing. Experts tell us that this is a very special horoscope, which astrologers would note down.
Matthew describes the star as moving and then coming to a stop.
Exactly. This is consistent with Jupiter being the star, because Jupiter occasionally stands still. Jupiter is an outer planet. And outer planets, which are further away from the sun than the Earth is, are overtaken by the Earth. So once every 13 or 14 months, the Earth overtakes Jupiter in the Earth's inner orbit. And during such an event, what we witness is that planets, outer planets like Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn can stand still and can have the so-called reverse motion. Then you see them moving through the sky in a reverse direction and again standing still, and then can also move in another direction.
So this sounds like you said, it's very special, and it sounds pretty unique. So do you know how often something like this would happen?
Yeah, the massing of planets happens around once every 200 years.
Okay.
And if you want to have this in a certain constellation, and this is a point that we'll come to shortly, then it's more like there are 12 constellations, so then it is more like 2,500 years or so.
Okay.
And that you would have the massing of the planets with the sun and the moon in one constellation. And in a particular constellation, yeah, then you have to wait another 2,500 years.
Okay. So you mentioned that this constellation is Aries. So is
yes.
this does this have meaning that it was in this constellation for these astrologers?
So Molnar, who wrote that book, says yes. Molnar says Aries is the constellation of the Jews.
Okay.
And I love that explanation, and he had some reasons to believe that it was the case. But we had several experts at the meeting who had extreme doubts. So Aries, yeah, you could indeed connect Aries to Judea, but you could also connect it to Syria. You could also connect it to Libya.
Okay.
You could connect it to North Africa.
Okay. So the Magi who saw this star, I mean, they knew that it meant a few things.
Yeah.
First of all, or they supposed it was a birth, and so I'm curious why they think it was a birth rather than, say, a death, which I know also sometimes showed up in astrological symbols as well.
Yeah. No, I believe that this idea of these two other very massive planets of Jupiter and Saturn sort of rising before the sun means the birth of an important person.
Okay, so it's because it's rising before the sun.
Yeah.
Okay. And the king, I suppose, they tell it's the king because of Jupiter, which is the king of the planets. Is that correct?
Yes. It's the regal planet. Yeah.
And then finally, if there's this debate of what Aries means, whether it means for the Jewish constellation or not, how did these Magi know to come to Jerusalem in Judea?
Yeah, that was a big issue at the meeting. So we think they did not just go to Judea, because that never happens. So the experts at the meeting tell us that this sort of prognostic astrology was never done in the sense that people would then try to find a person with a certain event. They would probably write it down, and they would later on maybe explain some things. So this was done with Roman emperors, for instance. Yeah, some Roman emperors were very bad. And then later on, people could say, yeah, look at this horoscope. We could have known beforehand. So Magi would never travel to search for a person related to astrology.
Okay.
So then the question is, of course, what happened then? So there was no motive for Magi to start looking for this person, but there was another motive, and that is completely a different motive, that is politics. So we think that we are talking about people from Parthia. Now the Parthians was an extremely important people living in Mesopotamia, in the area of the Euphrates and the Tigris. So in the year 53 before Christ, a famous Roman general of the name Crassus was sent out by the emperor in Rome to defeat the Parthians. So he went out with a big army, and there was a very famous battle near the city of Carrhae, which the Romans lost very, very badly.
Mm-hmm.
So there are two sort of major defeats of the Roman army in the history of the Romans, and the worst one is the Battle of Carrhae. But the Parthians had an enormous admiration for Roman culture and for the Roman people. And so wealthy Parthians would send their children to Rome for their education. So there was sort of a need, which was around minus 20, that there would become sort of a more relaxed atmosphere, a peace between the Parthians and the Romans. So in minus 20, the Parthians brought the golden standards, which they had captured in the Battle of Carrhae, back to the Romans. So there are certain statues in Rome, and there are coins made by the Romans in which you can see this, in which you can see this very special event to them, that their standards, their aquilae, were returned to them by their enemies, by the Parthians. And in the subsequent years, there was a lot of, what would I say, political traffic between the Parthians and the Romans in order to make a peace process. They, of course, talked about this, and in those talks, always astrologers were involved. And the peace process was actually signed in a peace summit in plus one, the year plus one. So the years between minus 20 and plus one were extremely relaxed. There was this this peace process going on in which Magi played an important role. Now, to this has to be added that those peace discussions, conversations, took place in sort of the Roman capital in the east. And the Roman capital in the east was Antioch. And now, I don't know if you know this, but Antioch happens to be the city where Matthew would later write his gospel.
Okay.
Yeah, so what Van Cotten and I think is that there was no need for the Magi to travel to Judea, and they probably never came there, but they really came to Antioch, may have told there this story of this astrological event that they had seen and which they had not understood. And that story just may have lived along in Antioch and was later picked up by the first Christians, and who communicated this to Matthew. Because, you know, Matthew would write in only plus 70 years later, decades later.
So this might not depict an actual visit of the Magi, but it was later on that the early Christians put together the pieces of the puzzle connecting Jesus' birth with this astrological symbol that happened around the same time.
Yes. Yeah, at least that is my explanation. There's also others who say, oh, maybe these Magi traveled around and visited other Roman capitals, and they also came in Jerusalem and told the story there. I cannot exclude that.
Right.
Yeah. So they do not have to visit one place. There's plenty of time that they could travel around.
So another question I have is, were the Magi able to differentiate that this would be a messianic king rather than a worldly king? Or again, is this something that was later pieced together by the early Christians?
Yeah, I think that was later pasted together.
Okay.
Yeah, it as I see it, it just happens to be an astrological event which was reported and which the Christians could use for their campaign, for their Jesus campaign,
right?
And which was remembered in Antioch, and which Matthew picked up again decades later.
So outside of Matthew's gospel and outside of the actual astrological charts that you can reconstruct now, looking at the history and the historical records, is there any evidence of this conjunction being a really important thing that people have noticed?
No. You need to practice astrology. Yeah, and there are other examples of horoscopes of Roman emperors, for instance, really famous people, where very similar horoscopes to this Jesus horoscope that I was just describing had been noticed.
Okay.
Yeah, so there is an horoscope of Emperor Hadrian, and that can be compared very well with the Jesus horoscope that I've just described to you. And there is an astrologer, Antigonus of Nicaea, and he also pointing at the fact that Jupiter was very too close to the moon. He calls this importance of the spear bearers, Saturn and Mercury in this case. Yeah, so that was another horoscope which made fame for this Emperor Hadrian. So we're not inventing things here. This astrology was very important. Mm-hmm. And Molnar has pointed out that there was an horoscope, or I should say an astrological situation in April minus 6, which would really count as very, very important for the people with the astrological know-how.
As far as the meaning behind this story, so If you put yourself in the mindset of the early church and the early Christians, what would this story have meant to them, and why would he tell it? What is the deeper meaning behind it, do you think?
Well, I would think that any story in which you put historical elements have a higher chance of being remembered by people. Mm-hmm. So if they can connect the story to things that they already knew from their grandparents, things that really happens, that makes it easier to take, to use these historic facts. Mm-hmm. And you should know, and you probably know, that Matthew was a Jew, and he was a very intellectual Jew. So his story differs from Luke's story. Yeah. So in Luke's story, we get the story of the shepherds.
Right.
And so Matthew is bringing in this point of even heathen people from foreign countries expressing an interest in the birth of this child. But there are certain elements in the story that he cannot have just made up himself. Mm-hmm. So he's using some historic facts just to give his Jesus story more credibility.
Yeah, well, it's all very interesting. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much for joining us on the podcast today.
It was a pleasure.
This is Elizabeth Fernandez for Spark Dialogue Podcasts. You can now sign up to receive notices of new podcast episodes straight to your email inbox. Go to sparkdialogue.com/podcasts to sign up. And you can always check us out on facebook.com/sparkdialogue or on Twitter @sparkdialogue. This episode wraps up season 1 of our podcast. That means we'll be taking a short break and returning next year for season 2 with a new episode every other Tuesday. Starting on January 17th, we will be joined by Cassandra Carmichael from the National Religious Partnership for the Environment, Rabbi Fred Shalinder Dobb from the Coalition of the Environment and Jewish Life, and Sultan Bryce from Green Muslims, to talk about climate change, from the science to the politics to the moral implications. This is Elizabeth Fernandez, and as always, thanks for listening.